And I'd like at this time to introduce David Cole, who is our presenter this morning. And as we outlined earlier, we're moving from the broader context, and in later series tomorrow, we'll look more specifically at the ag lending sector. The 17th, we're going to break it right on down to what loan officers are looking for with individual borrowers, and then on the 24th, look specifically at some tools. But there's probably no one better, and we're really fortunate, to have Dr. Cole to talk about the greater, the larger context here. For 25 years, Dr. Cole was a professor of agricultural finance and small business management and entrepreneurship at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia. Presently, or more recently, he was on special leave with the Royal Bank of Canada working on advanced initiatives and also assisted in the launch of a successful entrepreneurship program at Cornell University. He has addressed the American Bankers Agriculture Conference for over 30 consecutive years, so they wouldn't have invited him back if it wasn't of value to them. And he's appeared before numerous state banker schools and conferences throughout the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. He is a chancellor of the Farm Credit University, which has trained over 700 lenders using an online and face-to-face educational approach. He, as a facilitator, played a key role of the Canadian Agriculture Financial Standards Task Force and was one of the leaders in establishing the guidelines for standardized reporting and analysis of agriculture producers' financial information. If you would like more information about Dr. Cole, we have a full bio up on our website. But at this time, I'm just going to turn the program over to Dr. Cole, and when he's finished with his presentation, we'll have a chance to interact with him on the questions that you provide through his presentation. So, Dr. Cole, the program is yours at this point.
Okay, thank you, John, and it's a pleasure to be with everyone here today. Matter of fact, you were saying good morning. It's actually afternoon here on the East Coast, and so we're going through many time zones. It was real interesting to look at the and examine the survey information. This last year, we did 28 webcasts, and we've been doing them for about 3 or 4 years now, and they're becoming very, very popular at delivering various information. Today, I have three primary objectives. Number one, since the first year, I've been in 36 states, four Canadian provinces, and I just came off the LSU Graduate School of Banking, where we had 553 lenders, and I taught an agricultural course and a general economic course there. So one of the things is I'm going to try to give some perspective that we see from the road. One of the objectives is to take you up 50,000 feet today. Particularly, this is the kickoff webcast of this series, and we're going to look at the agricultural industry, we're going to look at the global economy, and also we're going to look at and examine the domestic economy and some of the impact it's going to have on various financial variables in the U.S. agricultural arena. Second, we're going to look at and examine some of the issues between borrowers and lenders that we presently see on the line. And then one of the things that I would like to do is take the liberty to address some of the educational needs that I see, both micro and macro, as it pertains to risk management. So with that in mind, I'm going to go through a series of slides. I may not cover all the slides and get your questions ready toward the end. And I'd like to start out with slide number one. And let's go to Wall Street, December 18th. And I was there addressing the National Agricultural Finance Committee, and a Wall Street reporter asked me a very, very interesting question. He said, Dr. Cole, he says, what's the biggest financial revelation of 2008? And I know I disappointed him because I didn't show up in the Wall Street Journal, but my response was very, very succinct. Financial change and economic change occurred so rapidly and so abruptly. However, I said that's not only a 2008 syndrome, but that's going to be your next decade in agriculture. And so one of the things that I would just like to say is, if you really look at the U.S. economy, we were living off a balance sheet basically over the past 25 or 30 years, and I'm talking about the general economy. And, you know, right after World War II, President Eisenhower came back and said, well, we got to invest in infrastructure, the interstate. We also got to send our GIs back to college. And that reaped us dividends, folks, and gave us a higher standard of living, particularly in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. However, through the Marshall Plan, where we reconstructed Japan and also Germany, they took our automobile industry and our manufacturing industry, and they basically made it better. And of course, we didn't adapt to that change, and we put our bets, of course, into high tech. And of course, that accelerated during the 1990s. And then there was this whole thing where Y2K was going to shut down the world. And of course, substantial investment and overinvestment was made in that arena. However, when that crashed, then the what I call the silk suit money or the funny money basically moved into suburban and urban real estate. And of course, when that crashed, you will notice that the money moved into commodities all the way from oil, gold, wheat, corn, soybeans. And of course, it drove those markets up. And now basically what you have is the funny money's on the sidelines, just playing around a little bit. But what's happening is we're moving into a period, not only in the United States, but worldwide, into a period of economic moderation where you're going to see volatility. But in our risk management challenge, it's going to be volatility at the extremes. And one of the things that I would say is, as we look at the economic recovery, I think one of the things that we've got to be very, very careful of is what they call dead cat bounces and false recoveries, where we go out there and basically do a 5-10 year plan based off a recovery that may happen to be false, and then we're right back into the same type of mess or the same type of syndrome. One of the things that I think is going to be very, very key, particularly as it pertains to risk management, is we're going to have to reprioritize and we're going to have to refocus. And one of the things that I think is essential in risk management planning is to constantly visit business, family, and personal goals. And one of the things is, in risk management, it's to bring objectivity to a very, very emotional roller coaster type of environment. And that's going to be one of the challenges to lenders, but also to educators and risk managers out here as we move forward. Looking at some of the views from the road, as John mentioned, the livestock and protein industry, it's in dire straits. Matter of fact, export demand's down. Of course, we see higher feed costs, and of course, the slowing economy has impacted us in that arena. And also, we probably have a little bit of overcapacity. One of the views that I really see from the road is the agricultural adversity has not been as great in the agricultural arena as it has been in the strong in the general economy because of strong balance sheets. And I'm going to come back and address that. And one of the things that's going to be very, very critical, particularly in 2009, down around the corner, but also down the road, is that we are very, very real estate dependent, particularly on the U.S. farm balance sheet. Another thing that's really starting to emerge its ugly head is third-party counterparty risk. We're seeing much more complex operations. Of course, we've had adversity in the ethanol industry. Of course, we had Pilgrim's Pride with adversity in some of the integrators and some of our agribusinesses. And I think in a risk management context, we're very, very vulnerable to the third-party counterparty risk. Also, one of the variables that's probably going to emerge, it hasn't quite hit us yet, is the whole reliance on off-farm income. And it was real interesting, John, when you were doing the surveys. We got some small farms, people that deal with small farms, and some that deal with commodities and large commercial farms. Well, 70% to 80% of U.S. agriculture and Canadian agriculture, if there's anybody north of the border on this webcast, is dependent in one shape or manner in non-farm income. And with the unemployment rate now at 9.4%, but actually the unemployment rate is 16.4% because the unemployment rate does not include people who have been cut back on hours. It does not include the discouraged workers or small business owners who have closed their door. And with a heavy dependence on off-farm income, a cut back on hours, cut back on fringe benefits can play an integral role, particularly in risk management, particularly as it pertains to the smaller mid-sized farm operations. Also, lenders are rationing credit. Credit is available, but one of the things is they're requiring more information and they're carefully scrutinizing that information. And as I've seen this winter, we do have some stray dogs that have been put out on the street. Any of you dealing with the forestry industry, of course, housing, think about this. Our housing starts are a third of what they normally should be. We have 4 million homes vacant that are in inventory, so a rebound in that sector is very, very critical for the forestry industry. And of course, the export markets have cooled a little bit as we've had the global economy. However, if you look at the grains industry, one of the things is the financial stress has not hit that arena yet. And that has basically been the result of what we call a century of super cycles. And let's just talk a little bit about these super cycles. There's been four major super cycles in the past 100 years. And the first super cycle was back in World War I. Inflation was widespread. It hit metals and agriculture, and we were up about 33%, 34% from the trough to the peak, and it lasted about 4 years. Actually, this super cycle kicked off the first depression before the Great Depression in 1917 and 1918 as people were moving from the farms to the cities. By the way, during this period, the United States was taking over from Europe as the world economic power, which Europe took over from China, who was a major economic power for about 400 years. The next era was right after World War II, where we had rapid world economic growth. We had the Korean conflict. Inflation was limited. We had post-war reconstruction. It hit metal and agriculture again, and we were up about 47%, and it lasted about 3 years. The next one in 1973 and 1974 was kind of a false type of super cycle, in a sense that our government, and we had a famous Secretary of Agriculture who I knew up until his death about 2 years ago, Dr. Earl Butz, he basically said the words, "We got to plant fence row to fence row." And boy, this encouraged investment not only in agriculture, but we saw inflation in oil. And from the valley to the peak, we were up about 59%, and it lasted 2 years. One of the things that's real interesting is this. That was the prelude to the farm crisis during the 1980s. Now, the latest super cycle, we had rapid economic growth worldwide. It was created basically by India and China, and also with the advancements to alternative fuels. And this is the first time oils, metal, and agriculture all aligned. We were up 131%, and it lasted 5 years. Now, the next big question, particularly as it pertains to livestock and protein, but also to the grain industry, will this super cycle continue in 2009, or will it ebb out? Now, one of the things that's real interesting is this. If we take a global view, one of the things about a global view, and I'm showing you a November slide, and then I'm also showing you an April slide. Let's go back to the November slide. And what's real interesting is this is how economic change occurred so rapidly worldwide. In November, they were projecting that, who's they, the IMF, was basically projecting the United States, Canada, and Mexico to grow about a negative 1%. Now, carefully remind you is that's 5% of the world population, but 29% of the world economy. Let's go over to Europe. They were projecting that to grow about negative 1%, that being 7% of the world population and 29%, or excuse me, 25% of the world economy. Let's go to Japan. They were projecting Japan to grow at about a 1% rate. And you take Japan, Europe, and North America, two-thirds of your world economy comes out of those regions, okay? Now, what's real interesting, if we fast forward to April, one of the things that you will see is, look at how the ball, it was kind of like a curveball dropping off the table. United States, negative 6.3%. Mexico, negative 10. Canada, negative 3.4. Germany, negative 8.2. The whole Eurozone, negative 6%. But look at Japan, negative 12%. Now, one of the things that's real interesting is, if you look at those three areas of the world, this really hit our protein industry. And whether the super cycle is going to continue or not continue, one of the things that we see is, let's go to China, Russia, and India. China, or particularly Russia, let's stop off at Russia. We were seeing substantial growth, particularly in the Ukraine region. Matter of fact, they were taking a number of the collective farms and turning them into commercial farm type of operations. Matter of fact, you couldn't buy a Deere tractor or a Red tractor. You couldn't buy a combine last year. However, when Russia decided to invade Georgia, all the investment pulled out of the Ukraine. And when that pulled out of the Ukraine, it was interesting to watch Deere stock go from $80 a share to $30 a share. And the point I'm trying to make here is, little things that happen in the globe can come back and directly impact the cost of inputs, capital costs, but it also can impact the global markets. Matter of fact, if you look at the poultry industry, where a substantial amount of poultry goes into Russia, of course, Russia cuts back, Russia goes into a slower economy, and of course, that hurts our export demand. And one of the things to keep in mind is that much of the urea of the world is produced in the Ukraine region, and of course, the financial, economic, and political health of that region is going to be very, very critical, particularly over on the input side. Now, let's stop off at China and India. It's real interesting. China's growth is about 6.1%. In India and China, and particularly in emerging countries, a recession is considered growth rates of about 3%. Now, China's growth rate, the Chinese Communist Party would like to see about an 8% growth rate to keep social turmoil to a minimum. However, if we happen to see the growth rate go back up toward 10%, then your super cycle is on. However, if their growth rates, and particularly India's growth rates, start going back towards the 3%, then there's going to be pressure, particularly on grain commodities, and it's also going to be pressure on our ability to export in that region of the world. So one of the things, if the growth rate goes back up toward 10%, then we'll definitely continue this super cycle. One of the things that I would say from a risk management standpoint and from a capital cost standpoint, the Asian region has been making substantial investment in the Southern Hemisphere, not only in South America, but in Africa and in Australia, both politically and financially. In the long run, as we go down the road toward 2020, this may come back to influence the financial structure and the economic structure of American agriculture. So we'll have to kind of keep a close eye in this arena. Now, enough of the world economic growth, let's move into alternative energy. And if you think about agriculture in rural America, 8 out of every $10 spent on a farm and a ranch in a rural community is somehow connected to oil and oil prices. Now, some of you that are on this webcast remember last year at this time when oil prices were in triple digits, in U.S. dollars, I said by November, December, they could be back to $40 to $50 a barrel. Lucky guess? I don't know. But one of the things that I would suggest to you is I could give you a 20% probability that oil prices could go up above 100 toward $200 a barrel. The conditions that could lead to that is terrorists target the energy industry. We have Mother Nature targets the energy industry. Of course, we have political conflict in places like Iran, places like North Korea to South Korea. All those could shoot oil up to about $100 to $200 a barrel. One thing that we found was the consumer cuts back. The chicken point was about $4 a gallon on gasoline. I could give you a 20% probability where they could go under $40 a barrel, but it would require the emerging countries growing at a 3% or less rate, and even a negative rate. We continue, we being the United States of America, continue in on as in a recession. However, the sweet spot seems to be somewhere between $40 and $80 a barrel. You've noticed it's been trading in that high $60, $70 range. And one of the things that I see is probably the oil and gasoline prices are probably going to be in this area. As far as alternative energy is considered, what about ethanol, biodiesel, switchgrass, solar power, wind power? I think it's going to take a combination of all those factors. And again, ethanol is probably still going to be there. Our Secretary of Agriculture comes from the state of Iowa. Of course, ethanol is big in that state. But I do see this administration leaning toward wind power and also solar power. However, they also are receiving some environmental resistance in those two arenas. Bottom line is, in a risk management program, your input costs are going to be all over the board, not only down the road, but or around the corner, but down the road as well, until we not only have a U.S. alternative energy program, but a worldwide alternative energy program. And some people forget about that context. Now, as we catch our breath, now let's go to the U.S. farm balance sheet, and let's look at and examine U.S. farm real estate values. 87% of the U.S. farm balance sheet is in farm real estate. And of course, it makes the agricultural picture very strong. Our debt-to-asset ratio, all-time low at 10%. However, this could be a false nomer. And let's talk a little bit about farm real estate values and where they're going. And John, one of the things I'd like to have you do after discussion is to do a survey of the people that are on this program of what they see as far as real estate values, whether they're increasing, remaining neutral, or declining. Well, first of all, this is I want to thank Dr. Steve Isaacs, University of Kentucky. It's almost a 100-year century look at U.S. farm land values across the country. There's about seven major points I want to give from this slide. First of all, every time we had a super cycle, whether it was the teens, whether it was right after World War II, the 70s, and a current super cycle, land values go up. Remember, 80% of economics is psychological, and that's something that we have to deal with from a risk management context. Second, one of the things that I would suggest to you, every time we've had war, land values go up. World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, number one, Afghanistan, Iraq, number two. War creates a what? Premium for food fiber and fuel, but also people want to invest in hard assets. Again, that psychology kicks in. If you really examine the land values for the past 100 years, 80 of the 100 years land values were up. Matter of fact, up till World War II, the record was about 50-50. Half the time they were up, half the time they were down. But since World War II, we've got a record of 63-7. Now, I noticed a number of land-grant institutions are sponsoring, and I appreciate the sponsorship. We take a 63-7 here at Virginia Tech for the next few years as far as a football record. That's a pretty daggone good record. And if you look at it, there was a period from about the late 1950s through the early 1980s. We were 27-0, and we're currently 21 years up, 0 years down. And what that does is it builds in a psychology of complacency. And again, it changes the risk management. One of the things that I would suggest to you is, though, land tends to be a wealth accumulator, not necessarily a cash flow generator. And generally, you will need cash flows from other sectors to justify the land values. And one of the things that's real interesting, as you evolve toward 2008, up to 40% of the land base has nothing to do with the capitalized return from agriculture. It has everything to do with the investment from the non-farm community as they invest in water rights, mineral rights, wind power, view sheds, development rights. And so it's going to be interesting to see how this prolonged recession is going to come back to influence our land values. There's one thing that I hear in recent years, that we're on a new normal, we're on a new plateau. And anytime you hear that from a risk management standpoint, you cover your behind side. And a lot of people are saying, well, it's different this time because we have a lot of cash buyers. Yes, they are cash buyers, but their cash is land locked. And should they need that cash, one of the things that I would suggest is if they need that cash, then they would have to put that land on the marketplace. So one of the things that I would suggest to you is, as we look at this land values, I would like to survey the group. How many are finding land values staying neutral in your area? How many are still seeing an increase? And how many of you are actually seeing declines? So that'd be some interesting discussion as we move a little bit later. Now, let's kind of move on to the next slide. And everybody says, well, when's this recession going to be over? Currently, we're in the 19th month. And one of the things that's real interesting is your typical recession lasts 11 months. Your typical business expansion lasts 58 months. So you have 5 good years to 1 bad year. However, many economists were saying, well, we're in the great moderation period. And matter of fact, if you looked at it, Paul Volcker went 106 months without a recession. Alan Greenspan broke his record 120 months. However, one of the things that we found was there's still these economic cycles and there's these economic waves, and it comes back to really influence the agricultural economy and the general economy. What are going to be some of the signs of the turnaround? Well, one of the things is there's 4 or 5 signs. And by the way, I've got other signs like the Purchase and Manager Index and the Composite Leading Index that are starting to show some positive signs. But housing put us into this recession. Housing will bring us out. However, last month we had 458,000 housing starts. We generally need 1.3 to 1.7 million. We do have 4 million vacant homes. So we have a lot of inventory out there, and a lot of inventory a number of people don't want to buy, because one of the things that we're finding is that the housing size of homes, energy efficient, all these contexts are changing as we have a new demographic coming into the housing market. Another one that you need to watch for a turnaround is copper prices. Matter of fact, Alan Greenspan used this as his early indicator of not only a turnaround in the economy, but potential inflation. But they have to be sustained for at least 6 months or more. The other thing that's very concerning on this economic turnaround is government debt to GDP. We're almost 100% government debt to GDP. However, 40% of that debt is basically financed by foreign lenders. And the foreign lenders that are financing it tend to be China, India, Britain, the Middle East, and the Caribbean region. And should they demand a higher risk premium, or if they should demand that they're going to keep their money at home, one of the things that I would just suggest to you is this could result in higher prices for our interest rates. Now, one of the things that I would suggest to you is whether we're deflation or inflation, one of the things that we're going to be in deflation early on, but then one of the things is I think from a risk management standpoint, what we have to do is we have to plan for the possibilities of inflation. So that's one of the things that's very concerning as we move down the road. Now, One of the things that I would just suggest to you is, what is the disconnect between borrower and lender's view on the agricultural economy? And one of the things that I'm finding very, very critical, and a number of borrowers are saying, well, I've got the equity, why can't I get the loans? Matter of fact, we're finding a number of people, particularly where they've been around areas of development, et cetera, are coming in and demanding refinance of loans. One of the things that I would suggest is cash flow and earnings pay loans back, not necessarily equity. Another disconnect between borrower and lender, a number of borrowers think that all banks receive TARP funds and basically they should get more favorable rates. Well, one of the things is not all banks receive the TARP funds, and one of the things that I would suggest to you is you need to communicate with your bank concerning that. Another challenge that I find is, and particularly in this arena, is if I'll borrow more money and that's going to kind of fix my problem. Well, not necessarily. One of the things is if you've got a challenge and you've got a problem, borrowing the money will actually put you into a deeper hole. And oftentimes the borrowers are recognize the problems and the challenges when they're too late, and also the lenders tend to delay action because they're too busy. And both of these can really lead to a challenging type of environment. And time is of the essence when you're dealing with challenging and problem loans. Also, many farmers and ranchers feel they're different. Well, not necessarily. Matter of fact, you've got to operate it as a business, and you can't just use the general economy as an excuse. And one of the things that I would just suggest to you is economic cycles are going to ebb and flow. And so one of the things that is very, very critical is that we operate and look at from a risk management standpoint from a business component. Also, lenders think globally and producers tend to think one track. That is a challenge, but also is a blessing because when they both work together, it brings a global view and a one-track view together for a win-win type of situation. Also, borrowers are starting to question, why should I have to provide all this detailed information? And why can't I get the low rate? One of the things that I would suggest to borrowers is oftentimes we have to earn our rate, and so we have to provide the balance sheet income cash flow statements, but we also have to provide the business plans. Now, we also have to look back and say, well, the lenders also contributed to the crisis, and not necessarily the ag lenders here, but you know, I kept hearing 3 or 4 years ago, well, you can't make a bad loan. Well, you can't make a bad loan when land is appreciating. Also, one of the things is many of our lenders became too growth-oriented and financial engineering looking at next quarter's results. And this is a lesson that we learned over in the general economy that I hope does not come back into the agricultural arena. Also, deals have become more leveraged, more complex with multi-entities, third-party, counterparty risk. And then when we did underwriting and we put covenants in, we didn't enforce those covenants, and we had what they call a covenant light. Also, we become, particularly in agriculture, over-rely on non-reoccurring income. For example, the sale of capital assets, of land to bail out our financial problems, or the sale of excess livestock, etc., etc. And so one of the things is if we build these into our cash flows year after year, when we can't sell them, then we have a financial challenge. I talked about the false sense of security on real estate. It moves us oftentimes to the 5 C's of lending: collateral, 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 collateral. However, cash flow and earnings pay loans back. Also, we had lenders get into new industries with no expertise. Related also to the whole area of, we saw it in the wine industry, we saw it in the ethanol industry. Again, what you have to do is build that expertise and build it very, very quickly. And I'm not saying the wine industry, the ethanol industry wasn't a good industry, but again, some of the lenders got outside their areas of expertise. Also, there was an over-reliance on statistical models and credit scoring. And I'm not against statistical models or credit scoring. They are a tool. However, oftentimes we checked our brains at the door. And one of the things is credit scoring and statistical models work as a tool, but you can't get away from knowing that customer. And so that's where this relationship lending is very, very critical. And then, of course, we had a number of outside entities, contingent liabilities that we became very, very dependent upon. Now, as we kind of move toward the end of our webcast here, a couple of things that I would just like to say is, number one, if it grows too fast, it's a weed. In risk management, remember, the number one reason why businesses fail is growth. 25% of all small businesses that file bankruptcy, which agriculture included in those small businesses, file bankruptcy after their most profitable year. Next, if you've got the dirt, you can't get hurt. That is an attitude. Remember, in the 1980s, some people had to sell the dirt, okay, to get out from under it, to lower their overhead cost. Here's another one. Land, they aren't making anymore. It's not about land. It's about its qualities and its attributes. And another one that we're hearing right now, well, we have a lot of cheap money, so I'm going to go out and borrow and expand. Remember, money, it can be cheap, but if you can't pay it back, it becomes very, very expensive. I'm also hearing, well, I'm going to go with this lender because the rates are cheap. Remember, knowledge, stability, all those attributes in a risk management plan are just as important, if not more important, than interest rates. Here's one that comes out of Ontario, Canada. Out of Ontario, Canada, we had some folks say, well, I left a lot of money on the table because of a marketing plan. I had two young men up there said that they executed a corn contract the next couple of days. The corn went up 50 cents a bushel. When they got back home, their fathers and grandfathers really let them have it. And one of the things that I would just tell you is the past economic environment has set marketing and risk management back 10 years, and those people who desire to hit the peak are destined to hit the valley when it comes to commodity prices. Another thing is, and I've talked about this, if you ever hear we're on a new plateau or a new normal, one of the things is you better step up your risk management plan because the psychology has kicked in. Couple of other things is I've got to minimize taxes. This is something for 2009 around the corner here that we're really going to have to watch for because there's some very, very lucrative risk management plans. And then finally, just be careful of people in silk suits, the Wall Street types, or the people in your communities that can come in, get an industry overheated, and then when they pull out, they create a vacuum. Now, let's conclude down and talk about how we can counter the stress cracks. First of all, I heard in Oklahoma one organization that was basically rejecting people because they actually showed a negative cash flow. False. You have to do a trend analysis. And if a person has shown profits in the past few years and has one bad year, you've still got to stick with them. Also, you have to do an examination of earned net worth versus appreciated net worth. And what percent of the balance sheet came from earned net worth or the click of a computer button, which increased the land values. And this is an analysis in risk management that you're really going to have to do. Also, risk management has to have a communication context. Borrower to lender, borrower to spouse, etc., etc. Also, lenders need to be very selective on new business and the stray dog credit. There's an old adage. One of the things is a new credit can be five times more risk and take five times the amount of time, money, and effort to handle than a new or an existing credit. Another thing that's very, very critical is business plans, and variance analysis. Folks, I've been on a lot of business turnarounds, and I'm actually owner of an operation where we use this. It's a dairy business, a value-added business, and one of our key tools is variance analysis. And here's what we'll do. We actually take the actuals to the projected, and then we will say, okay, what were the macro factors that created this, and what were the micro factors? And then we basically say, okay, was it the result of management, or was it the result of macroeconomic type of events? Another thing that I think is very, very critical is we need to have a three-prong marketing and risk management program. And we need to make progress here. One for the revenue, one for the cost and input side, and one for the interest rate side. Another thing that is going to be very, very important is personal family living budgets. One of our sponsors, the Farm Management Center up in University of Minnesota, has some excellent family living costs, along with some of the record systems like in Nebraska, Illinois. What we're finding is the average farm family living cost $55,000, but for some producers, it's averaging as high as $89,000 annually. Another risk management component that's going to be very important is sensitivity analysis on profits, but also on liquidity and working capital. As we will see, products in inventory like corn, wheat, soybean, or feeder cattle can go up and down. So we constantly have to do sensitivity tests there, but we also have to do sensitivity tests on collateral. And if people decide to sell, deferred taxes are very, very critical element. Now, let me conclude down and talk about some of the things that I see as far as educational needs. And again, I come to you from as an academic, former academic, but working the field. We need some education on working capital and working capital management. A number of people think it's the balance in the checking accounts. Others think it's the cash. That area right there is going to be very, very critical, particularly for the heavily leveraged farms. I talked about cash flow budgeting and variance analysis, but another thing that we have to really examine is have people do a profitability analysis. How are they going to use their profit? What's the 60-30-10 rule? It's something that we use in our business. 60% of our profits are designed to build efficiency, grow incrementally, or pay down debt, but the ultimate goal is to increase earned net worth. 30% is to build working capital. 10%, we call it funny money. We do what we want to do. We talked a little bit about the three level of marketing and risk management program. We also need to stress in risk management education, management succession. Estate planning is very, very important, but a critical element is transferring the management of that business from one generation to another generation, or one business owner to another business owner. Expansion planning and volatility management and business plan development, very, very important. But one thing that I find is really lacking in risk management is sometimes we develop great strategies, but we lack the execution and the follow-up. And of course, the old cash to accrual and business analysis monitoring is very, very critical, along with deferred tax consequences and sales situations. But from a risk management standpoint, emphasis also has to come on personal finance and investing, though a number of people's 401ks have gone to 201ds, but the whole personal finance and 401k investing, particularly for the younger beginning farm borrower, is going to be very, very critical. Finally, from a macro standpoint, if anybody can explain ACRE, and some of the government programs out there in less than a day, more power to you. But we definitely need, as we have more government programs come along, to be able to explain these programs. Also, we need education, particularly on this macro economy that I discussed earlier on, and how deflation, inflation, currency valuation, business cycles influences the overall balance sheet, but income statement and cash flow of the agricultural economy. Of course, consumer, food safety, environmental trends needs consistent education. And then, for example, the impact of the global economics on the agricultural industry. For example, I gave you the example of Russia and its impact on the deer stock, and also the access to being able to get and have combines and tractors, but also its impact on fertilizer prices. This is an educational component that I see is going to be very, very important. And one of the questions I would have for the whole group is, and it would be really good because we got a number of people on this webcast, what are your top five risk management educational needs as far as risk management? It would be real interesting to poll the group and see what comes about. So those are my formal comments. I'll open it back up to you, John.